Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. It's a warm Wednesday afternoon in June, and if it's a warm Wednesday afternoon in June and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, then you're listening to me, Phil Colicchio, bringing you the business of the business. That is the show on the Heritage Radio Network that explores the business side of the hospitality industry. And whether or not you are a regular listener, you should know that this show talks about how the business side of the equation works. Sometimes it's restaurants, sometimes it's hotels, sometimes it's food trucks, sometimes it's yachts, sometimes it is catering, sometimes it's writing. And I guess the best thing I could say about it is it's variable. The subject matter here on the show is variable. If you miss the show live, coming to you live today from Brushwick. If you missed the show live, you can always find us as an archived show at www.heritageradio.org or as a podcast on iTunes. And before we get started today, I want to make mention of two things. Number one, I want to welcome back and congratulate our erstwhile engineer, Jack Inslee, from the outer reaches of Bonnaroo in Tennessee, and he looks healthy and happy, and that means that I'm sure his DJ gig went really well. Congratulations on that, Jack. That is a monumental achievement, and I hope you'll let me interview you about it one day, because that is one of the most interesting business concepts that I've come across in the hospitality industry. The second thing I want to remind everybody about is my proud association with this organization. The Heritage Radio Network is 5 years old this year. And if you even remotely enjoy all of the varied programming on this radio station, on this home of the food and hospitality-related podcasts, then I want to urge you to go onto the website and become a member. It's a terrific organization. Membership will provide you with additional insight into what goes on here at Heritage and a lot more that goes around Heritage. As many of you know, Heritage is based in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Bushwick is a thriving community of every kind of people, as the song goes. And I just gave my guest today a little tour of the outside of Roberta's here at Brooklyn. And I would say to you that if you've never been here, come. If you've not eaten at Roberta's, please do. And if you'd like to visit us at the station, check us out. We're the real deal here at Heritage Radio Network. So now that that bit of business is done, I want to get down to the business of the day. My guest today is really one of the more interesting guys that I have met in the hospitality industry, because he examines it from a perspective that very few do. I have today, it's an honor to have Michael Klein, the insider. Michael is the editor and producer of Philly.com's food e-periodical, and I call it an e-periodical, not a blog. I think it significantly raises the bar if you were to call it a blog. and writes the Table Talk column for the venerable Philadelphia Inquirer. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I am really psyched that you're here. If regular listeners of the program know that I have a bit of a Philadelphia bias, and it's a good bias because I think Philadelphia is really a laboratory for what's new in the hospitality industry in 2014. And I've often told people that Philadelphia is now what Brooklyn was 5 years ago. It's a town with a lot of neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods support the restaurant industry in particular. And a significant reason that they do is because of what you do.
Well, I don't take credit for that, but I like to follow the industry in the city. It's fascinating. I've been doing this for 21 years now. And do you want to hear how I got started?
You know what? I absolutely do. And I do want to give you the credit because part of what we're going to talk about today is, and next week, we're going to have you come back, all right, and talk through this. But the impact of social media on the business of the restaurant industry has been tremendous. And you've been a pioneer, frankly, in all that. Well, it's true. Well, So how does Michael Klein get started in this electronic intranet jungle?
Well, because I started out in print. I'm the son of restaurateurs, and I grew up working in restaurants there. Well, not really theirs because I was way too young. My father actually had a lunch truck when I was 5 years old. And this is a lunch truck before lunch trucks and food trucks became cool.
Wow.
It was just Meals on Wheels. He used to show up at construction sites and feed the workers. It was very simple and basic. But he died when I was young, and then I just fell into restaurants as a teenager working there. And I realized pretty quickly that I didn't want to work in restaurants forever. It was a well, I mean, think about, and I say this
it's hard
too,
work.
Well, I like hard work.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody could ever fault me for that, but I don't know. Like, for example, chefs. Do you ever see old chefs and baby pigeons? You never see them.
I always say squirrels never die natural deaths.
That's right.
Exactly.
And so I decided long ago not to get into it, but I always loved the business. And in 1993, our restaurant columnist, who used to basically rewrite press releases about restaurant specials.
This is the columnist in the
Philadelphia Inquirer, right? And he was retiring. Well, right down the street, the convention center, the Pennsylvania Convention Center, was being built.
Right.
So that was a watershed moment in Philadelphia. That's when the city began to migrate from a sleepy backwater, the old WC lines. I went to Philadelphia once and it was closed, that kind of thing. A lot of interest was popping up in Philadelphia. And I said to the editors, I was working in the features department as an editor then, I said, how can you let this beat die? And they said, well, who wants to do it?
Wow.
And I, of course, the schmuck that I am, I raised my hand. And
now, there's a difference, though, to what you do and what a food critic does, right?
And definitely. I mean, when people say, did you review such and such, I look at them like, didn't you read what I wrote? I'm not writing criticism. I'm really writing. Okay, here's the main difference. If you want to distill the difference,
I do.
I write about the people and the business, and not the food.
Right,
and that's the big difference. I mean, I couldn't tell you. I'm not really well versed in food itself. I mean, I'm a passable cook, home cook. I can identify. I could probably get through a meal, but I don't have any pretense as a critic. And frankly, I'm pleased by just about everything.
Well, that would make us brothers from another mother.
There you go.
Because my focus in the industry is not on being sort of a foodie and a restaurant maven, but I am every day surprised at what I learn about the restaurant industry and its challenges, and we're going to talk about the variables in that industry, and they are many. Now, before we do, I want to take this in a little more of a traditional route. You grew up in Philadelphia?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and so because I also want people to know how does somebody become Michael Klein and what he does? He's a journalist. Journalist with a business bent and a journalist with a background in restaurants, and happens to be living in a time when there seems to be no ceiling on the interest that people have in all things restaurant right now.
I really think, it's lightning in a bottle because, again, 1993, interest starts to rise. And if you go back into history, that's really when the Food Network started.
Yeah.
And the whole concept of celebrity chef we had in Philadelphia, a few chefs that were fairly well known, George Perrier.
That's right.
Was the chef that everybody knew. And he actually had some international reputation. But
so did Joe Poon.
Joe Poon, yes. And
Joe's Duck House.
Right. Yes, that's right. Joe's Peking Duck House. Yep. And he's faded out of the spotlight. He's still around, though.
They've both faded a little bit.
Yeah. George has faded considerably.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It was a really great time, and following that arc of the Food Network, and then now every TV network there is has some kind of food show.
Right. And again, the interest is they program it because people watch it. They're not doing it because they're trying to break new ground anymore.
No.
I think every time they've resolved the last possible contestant show, there's another one.
They keep coming up with them. But people like it. People also, they gravitate towards celebrities. I think that there's a tendency to put chefs up on a pedestal. I mean, look at Top Chef.
I've heard of that show.
Yeah.
I've heard of that show. And I've heard that it's done some remarkable things for people who appear on it.
Yeah.
For 11 years.
Right. You know? There you go.
No, I'm very proud of what my cousin Tom has done on that show because it's I think as those type of shows goes, it's a show that still has a lot of integrity, and each day that people remind me about how much they love it, I'm prouder of really what's been done there. But you didn't you began in Philadelphia, but you didn't stay in Philadelphia your whole career. You actually had some time up here in the Apple, right?
Well. It was actually my pre-Inquirer days. I was a news editor at the Post, and I was writing headlines at the Post.
How old were you?
25.
And you were writing headlines for the Post.
It was the most.
I thought you had to be 13 to write headlines for the Post.
Oh no, you just have to think like a 13-year-old. It's the most fun you can have in journalism with your pants on. It really
is. So give me a Post story.
Okay, the one that I was hired on.
Yeah.
My tryout, and it was a little brief about an ungrounded lamppost in the Netherlands that was electrocuting male dogs. So they said, come up with a headline like right now. So the first thing, am I allowed to say this word on the air? I guess I am.
Yes, you can.
Okay. So the what I came up with was piss of death. It ran one edition, quickly got subbed out because somebody thought, it's one thing saying it on the air and 2014, and there's another thing about putting it in print in 1985. So,
well, we're going to have to figure out how to work that headline into one of your of your new spots when you're writing about the restaurants.
Maybe that would make a great drink.
Whoa.
Think about it.
No,
I think I'll have a piss of death.
No, we're not going to do that.
Okay.
Not even at Roberta's, who breaks the rules. We're not going to do that here. So, well, that time in New York, did you do any work in the hospitality industry then?
Not a thing. Not a thing. I was just an editor, and it was a great experience. But that was before the restaurant writing.
Well, when we I'm here today with Michael Klein, who is the insider. Put that in quotes. He's the insider, the editor, and producer of the food section of Philly.com, which is the internet version of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And if you don't know, the Philadelphia Inquirer has, I think they have the most Pulitzers, I think, of any of the Big East Coast newspapers. I mean, I want to make sure of this. If you're listening, the Inquirer was and still is a very venerable publication. It's lived through a lot in the past few years. But I want to take a little break now. When we come back, I want to talk with Michael, an observer of the restaurant industry in Philadelphia and other parts, about the variables that owners face in the restaurant industry. He has a couple of war stories for us. Mike, I think there's some pizza in our future.
Really?
You didn't come up here all this way for
for a glass of water.
That's right, not for a glass of water. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. This summer, Heritage Radio Network is turning 5. Since our launch in 2009, we've continued to bring you food and culture content like nobody else, and we need your help. Heritage Radio Network is a passionate, grassroots, action-oriented nonprofit organization. That means we depend on the support from listeners like you to keep us alive. If you love what you hear on Heritage Radio Network, visit our website and become a member today. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
This is Brooks Headley, the pastry chef at Del Posto in Manhattan, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Yes, you are. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network and Phil Colicchio bringing you the business of the business every Wednesday at 5 o'clock. Pure white fat marbling is what I heard during that break. It made me a little self-conscious, but but we'll move on from my problems. I'm here with Michael Klein, the editor of the Philly.com food electronic newspaper. And we wanted to come back. Michael's been gracious enough to come up here. I've been trying to get him to come up here to Brooklyn for a long time to sit in on the show. Michael observes the business side of the hotel industry. I'm sorry, the hospitality industry, emphasis on restaurants. And we've been talking for a long time about, man, what makes a restaurant work, what makes it not work. You know, he covers the births and the funerals of restaurants and restaurateurs. He covers their high times and he covers their low times. And I know that we've talked about his fascination with the variables that exist in this industry that seem to be unique to those people in the restaurant business.
I mean, when you think of any other business, how many variables can you think of? I mean, if you're in a manufacturing business, you know, cost of goods, marketplace, you know, you have, I don't know, let's say a handful of major variables.
And usually variables that you can underwrite and not control, but prepare yourself for shifts in market. You know, whether gas is $3.50 a gallon or $3.80 a gallon is really important to the Tasty Cake Company, right?
Of course.
Yeah. But in the restaurant industry,
who knows? Let's see. Your dishwasher is arrested for murder, and it comes out that he's here not only illegally, but had been deported and somehow found his way back in the country. How's that? That's a real-life story from yesterday.
You're not making that up. Tell me about it.
Well, It was rape. There was a doctor who was raped, and the prime suspect is a dishwasher, or was a dishwasher, at a moderately popular restaurant in Center City. And they quickly learned that this suspect was here illegally. He had been deported and somehow found his way back. The INS did not physically remove him from the country, but
right.
He's here, and now he's in jail. And so for the restaurateur, and I know that, let's face it, in the grand scheme of things, this is his problems are not. It's a problem for him, but in terms of, what's happening in society, it's there's a victim here. There's
sure
that's a
huge tragic development that is going to have repercussions upon the victim, the family of the victim, the coworkers of the victim, the restaurant owner, the restaurant, all of the employees at the restaurant. What's going to happen? And I think you pointed it out to me in a very sardonic way, right? That said, the day before,
he had
this
other
owner.
Problems.
This owner had no real problems.
Oh, he had other problems, but we all do. And he was, again, how do you plan for something like that?
Yeah, you don't.
You don't. And right. And so is it bad for a restaurateur to have news trucks outside of his restaurant for, one evening and the next morning? Is it
if
bad
that's the topic that they're covering, it's very bad for business.
Right.
And again, very bad for everyone involved. But that type of story is unfortunately, is emblematic of the somewhat insane nature of this industry. We all know that the industry hires a lot of immigrants.
Yes.
At low paying wage. The goal is to almost always, hire everyone in the legal fashion that is required. But not everybody can do a background check,
Well, actually you can. I mean, you can use the electronic system that the government gives you, but not everybody does this.
No.
And I'm not saying that I don't know that this one guy fall through the cracks. I don't know the situation here, but
well, you're going to be following it, right?
Oh yeah, and it's not good. It's not good for this guy, the owner.
We'll report back on it as time goes by. But this is a brand new news story. Speaking of variables, you and I talked about an article that appeared in yesterday's New York Times, that article was somewhat of a funeral piece because the historic, somewhat historic, if you can be historic in 30 years, the Union Square Cafe is going to be closing because it can no longer afford the rent that is going to be market rent at its location. And the story really explored how the neighborhoods in New York are usually populated by restaurants as they are growing, and that the restaurants bring life to the neighborhood, and inevitably the neighborhood and the real estate increases in value, and those restaurants can no longer afford to spend the same kind of rent and still make profit. I'm interested in your take on that, and is that a unique problem to New York, or is that a?
No, it happens all over, and it happens in Philadelphia. I mean, Walnut Street in Philadelphia, near Rittenhouse Square, was always the restaurant row. Well,
right.
Not always, from maybe the go-go years, the late '80s through the '90s.
Right.
It was, we had Striped Bass, Lebec Fenn, Susanna Fu, Circa. They were the pretty much
nationally acclaimed restaurants.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And great. And now every one of them is gone. Susanna Fu is now at Chipotle.
Oh.
She sold the building for $5 million and it's now at Chipotle. But, look at how much money they do a square foot.
That's right.
And at the end of Susanna Fu's run there, she probably wasn't doing half that business.
No, and as you pointed out when we were chatting before we went on the air, We share this unique quirk that we're not down on chain restaurants as a concept.
I actually liked chain restaurants, but not as so much as a consumer. But I think they show it's a barometer of a city's health.
Right.
And chains do not go. Chains vet their locations, and they have ironclad business plans. And if they don't think they're going to make money in a city or in a location, they're not coming.
So in Philly, that's very interesting you say that, because you know New York City just opened up its first Dairy Queen, believe it or not.
That's amazing.
It is. But what chain? I mean, what do you see in Philadelphia? What chain is the archetype that you're well, seeing? Because again, it's part of your business, part of what you're looking at.
Yeah, I mean, Ocean Prime, which is a chain out of Columbus, Ohio, opened here. They got savaged critically, but I mean, really savaged critically. But they're doing okay. Mm-hmm. They probably would be doing better if they marketed themselves better, but that's another story. I mean, Cheesecake Factory. Philadelphia is about to get its first downtown Cheesecake Factory.
Wow.
Right across the street from where Striped Bass used to be, 15th and Walnut.
No kidding.
And you think it's a chain restaurant, and that's who can afford it. But
I think that the Cheesecake Factory makes more people happy than any other place I have ever seen. I have never seen somebody in that place.
Oh, you missed my dinner a few years ago. No, seriously, it wasn't that great. But
they've got a good business formula, and it works. And I know that the listeners that listen to this show are usually more intrigued by great chefs and by really interesting restaurateurs. But I'm just as intrigued by what makes a chain restaurant work, what makes it sustainable, what makes it popular, and how they can really put in a really in a box, a theory of service, a theory of preparation that really can be universal, you know, in many ways.
Yeah.
Forget my theory about chain restaurants. I think they're a barometer of the economic health of a city, and of an area. We also got together a few months ago. You came. You were nice enough to cover a press conference that I was involved in which one of the groups that is seeking a casino license in the city of Philadelphia announced the engagement of two very well-known New York chefs who would take on restaurant space in his development. And the developer is Bart Blatstein, who's, from what I can see, is a very, very solid developer, man of his word in Philadelphia, has created some great areas in the town.
He has.
He solicited and these chefs accepted Andrew Carmelini and Tom Colicchio.
Yes.
What's Philadelphia gonna say about New York chefs coming to Philly?
That's happened before. It happens all the time. I mean, Philadelphia has become, you know, the old sixth borough thing, but I don't think Philadelphia will shun them. I really think a casino project, and this is just my observation here.
Yeah.
I think a casino project is just not the right venue for a well-known chef, especially in Philadelphia.
Let you off the hook on that. Why?
I'm only mildly because if you compare Atlantic City to Philadelphia, which you have to do because they're 60 miles and 1 hour apart.
Right.
Atlantic City has sort of nominally a resort atmosphere. Philadelphia doesn't. Mm-hmm. The venues that they're suggesting for two of the there are four candidates for a casino license.
Right.
It's the second casino license in Philadelphia. The first casino is doing okay. It's really nothing flashy about it. It's
right.
A utilitarian.
Slot machines, right.
Yes, it's a utilitarian casino. The second one, you know, everyone has much grander visions. Two of the four projects are for Center City. Two of them are for South Philadelphia in more of a, right now, an industrial and warehouse district. I don't know. I just don't see suburbanites, and this may be heresy, but I don't see suburbanites coming into the city if one of the two city center city licenses is awarded. I just don't see suburbanites, the people who would patronize these restaurants, coming into the city. I just don't see it. If Bart Blatstein was sitting here right here, I would tell him the same thing. I do know that one of the projects that's planned for the outskirts in South Philadelphia, people within the organization have suggested that if they don't get the casino license, they may go ahead with an entertainment complex.
Right.
Which is really intriguing to me because the location of this place is right off of two major highways, I-76, which is known as the Schuylkill Expressway,
right,
and I-95. So that if you're coming down from Bucks County, north of the city, or if you're coming in from the main line west of the city, you don't even have to go through the big, bad city, and I use air quotes that you can't see,
right,
to go to this project. And there would be other non-casino uses. I think, again, this is me, I think the casinos in the city tend to, I'm trying to think of a way to say this delicately.
Well, I'm going to...
indelicately.
Say it indelicately.
I just don't think that they will attract the masses that they really, that a casino like that really need.
Well,
I could be entirely wrong, and that's...
I think it all depends on, frankly, on what other states and cities that are regionally located decide to do.
Right.
Right? And so, you know, Atlantic City does not seem to be faring well. It will fare less well when another casino opens up in Philadelphia. Restaurateurs that we all know that are in Atlantic City are doing reasonably well from what I hear.
Right now they are, yes, that's true.
Right, but that's not going to continue. Can't continue.
No, I mean, the Revels on, is in danger of closing.
When that, well, I'm gonna get somebody from Revel on this show, so we're gonna walk through that.
Yeah,
that
I hope. I mean, that would be, a $2 billion casino closing.
Closing.
That would be mind-boggling. But the casinos, the restaurants at the, especially seasonally, are doing fairly well. They're doing okay.
Right.
And more coming in, believe it or not. So, but it's, again, it's like supply and demand. The pool of casinos, you add one more to the mix, and that's substantial.
Michael Klein, I thought the same thing about steakhouses, and I can't find one that closes.
Oh, Philadelphia, we had a glut a few years ago, and one closed, a substantial one closed, and another one changed its concept. So,
Michael Klein, who is the editor of the food section of Philadelphia.com and writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has been our guest today. Michael, I hope I can convince you to stick around and we can talk a little bit more about this and give it to the folks next week.
Sure.
For right now, I'm going to leave you with a thought, Michael, which is print media versus electronic media and how that has changed the restaurant industry since you began working. And that's what I want to bring in. That's what I want to talk about next week.
Great. That's Fair a enough? Great topic.
All right. Mike, thank you. Michael
My pleasure,
Klein,
Phil.
Thank you. Jack, I'm ready for my pizza, Jack. Bye, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. Phil Colicchio on the Business of the Business, heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.